Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Pixels, a show where we talk about video games and how fun they are and how wonderful everything is in the world of gaming and how there is absolutely nothing to do with the pandemic except for our first story. And that's it, probably, mostly. But it's going to be a fun show. We're going to be talking about Sony's plans for the release of PlayStation 5 as estimated by Bloomberg from what they've heard. We're going to be talking about some delays, Final Fantasy VII Remake, some other games that also exist, and a bunch of other things. Rumors, the launch of Stadia Base, which, again, Stadia is incredibly disappointing in everything they do. But I'm Patrick Beja, and I'm joined by Ed Mitchell, who's coming back to tackle all the things. How's it going, Ed?
It's good. It's good. You know, if there's one thing that this whole COVID pandemic is good for, it's staying inside and playing video games a lot. So
exactly. Exactly. And that's what we try to do. And I did play a lot. Well, I mean, I have a kid who isn't going to daycare, so a lot is to be qualified with that little caveat. I played a lot of Final Fantasy VII Remake. And I'm really liking the game. And there's a couple of other things, Other Waters and Iron Danger, which you've been playing, which you're going to be talking about. I think you might have mentioned when you were here earlier another time, maybe Iron Danger. I don't know. It rings a bell, but Other Waters, I have no idea what it even is.
Actually, I think that's right. I played it originally at PAX last year, and I think I might have mentioned it on the show that we did after that.
Mm-hmm. So you'll tell us all about both of those, and we'll be talking about a bunch of things. And let's get started with the one sad-ish news of the past couple of weeks, and that is the delay of The Last of Us Part 2 and Marvel's Iron Man VR on PlayStation 4 due to COVID-19. It is not because the game is not ready, which is the most frustrating thing in all of this. The game is ready, but they decided for logistical reasons to delay it indefinitely, meaning they don't have a date. I think it's because they don't want to give a date and then have to change it because everything is so uncertain at that point. But the reason why this is delayed, the most reasonable explanation is, I think, that they, for a big game like this, it is one of the major first-party releases of this generation, if not the biggest one. And for these games, you get a lot of your sales from actual stores, physical stores. It's not like you can just put them online and whatever, it's fine. Of course, many people already purchase things online, and many people who wouldn't have might do it if they didn't have a choice. But let's say 50% of the people buy it online anyway and download it. Another 50% would buy it in a physical copy, and half of those, so 25%, would go back to buying it digitally. That's still 25%, and these are made up numbers, but 25% of your sales is not insignificant at all, even if it's 20%, even if it's 15%. And for big games like these, it is they are aimed at a very wide population. It's not core gamer games, even like, you know, Final Fantasy VII might be considered, even though it's a big game. Like, these are The Last of Us Part II is a huge thing. And I think that is the reason why they're delaying it. They might fall back on a PlayStation 5 launch title like same time as PlayStation 5, maybe, we don't know. They're going to sell it anytime they decide to put it out. But kind of countering this argument is Iron Man VR, which is not a huge thing, but maybe they count on people going to buy VR headsets for Iron Man VR, which is, from the things we've heard, a pretty good game. So maybe that would explain it as well. No word on Ghost of Tsushima, which is supposed to be coming out at the end of June. It's a little bit later. The Last of Us Part 2 was supposed to come out at the end of May, so they have a little bit more time to see how things are happening for Ghost of Tsushima. But yeah, it's a little bit of a bummer, but what do you think? Are you sad?
I mean, of course I am. The Last of Us is a fantastic game, and I'm one of my favorite games of all time. I think the one thing that you didn't mention is like the supply chain logistics of getting the discs like printed and shipped and stuff like that. That's all like in a toss up right now. And so I think that has a heavy impact. Like, even if stores were open, I think they would have trouble getting the amount, the numbers to those stores because of all the supply chain problems.
One thing you could do in that configuration, you could start shipping early as quickly as you make them and set the date a little bit later, but then you get leaks and people who manage to buy the game anyway, so it's more difficult to control, and then you get people who have it, people who want it, who can't get it yet, so it becomes very messy, and even that kind of breaks the wave of your overwhelming success that you ride that wave to increase and have a snowball effect to get even more sales. So yeah, that might play a role as well.
Yeah, and as far as Iron Man VR, I think that since there was like no mention of that in the report, as far as like that it was good to go or whatever, I think it's just it was a little bit further out of its development time, or people were gonna crunch a little bit more to get it done, and now they can't do that as easily, I guess.
Yeah, I guess we'll see what happens there. Hopefully, it won't be pushed too much, and I guess they can't push it too much, because then PlayStation 5 is out. Although maybe they have a PlayStation 5 version ready to go as well, or it will be by then, and they can dual release it, but then they would lose the... my suspicion is they will push it to like September, because if there is a resurgence of the pandemic, it probably will quiet down during the summer, we're hoping, and if it comes back, it would be during the fall, and so September might work, I guess, but this is a completely uneducated guess, so I don't know. We also have news from PlayStation 5. I'll get to the launch report from in just a minute, but we had a reveal of the controller, the DualSense. They're abandoning the DualShock series naming convention, and they're going to DualSense. There was a blog post, it was revealed in a blog post, which was a little bit surprising, but since then we've heard that it's probably because they couldn't do a full press conference to reveal the full thing, and the developers have started getting the device, and so there would be leaks probably, and they were trying to get ahead of those, so blog post. And the blog post was published like 2 hours before the Microsoft's Xbox Insider, which was a little bit funny. I don't think it was malicious, but maybe it was a little bit of a dig. And what is important about that controller? It is dual tone. It has two colors, black and white. I think it looks pretty good.
Yeah, I think it looks good.
Yeah, it looks really nice. It looks futuristic. It might age a lot quicker than other designs because of that. What we consider now to be a little bit sleek and futuristic, in you know, 5 years, we might look at it and think, ah, that is so 2020. Yeah. But what it has a little lining of color in the design, which stands for the what's the name of the light bar thing for the previous controller? I think it's the light
touch
bar.
Pad?
Yeah, so it's on the sides of the touchpad, which is still there, so it will be compatible with old PlayStation 4 games. And it has, so other characteristics. Integrated mic, which I think is pretty cool. It will enable everyone to participate in voice chat. Of course, there's a button to turn it off if you want to. It might also mean that we're going to get some kind of PlayStation Assistant or some kind of voice commands more prevalent in the system. It's possible. There's also adaptive tension triggers, which will, we had heard about this in the Wired article a while back, but it will simulate the tension of, for example, the example they give all the time is a bow. If you pull right. the bow, it will become harder and harder to pull the trigger on the controller, which I think could be a really cool effect. And they also have what they call haptic feedback, which it's still unclear if this is different from quote-unquote HD rumble from the Switch Joy-Cons, which are pretty underwhelming. It's really just rumble. So it remains to be seen if that will be significant on the DualSense or if it's just, you know, different degrees of rumble, which in the end kind of feel like rumble anyway. But yeah. we'll see if it manages to create a different experience. The reporter from that Wired article seemed to say that it was an interesting effect and that it did work and that it was pretty cool. So we'll see. And but the other thing to note is that the PlayStation 4 controllers will probably work with PlayStation 5 consoles because none of these seem to be completely mandatory aspects of the device. If you don't have them, you can still control it.
It's interesting. The you know that story that came out about the release of the like rear like switches or buttons that like an attachment to the DualShock 4.
Right. People were like, how are they called? The paddles, the back paddles.
Yeah, the paddles. Yeah, yeah. People were speculating that the PS5 controller would have those like kind of quote unquote natively onto it.
Yeah, I was sure
why they released that, but. I mean, this thing doesn't seem to have that at all. So I'm kind of curious about like what their plan was with that.
Or I wonder maybe if they considered it and they developed the attachment in parallel right. because they wanted people to be able to get it. And then they bended it and they had the attachment ready to go. And they were like, maybe we can make a few million dollars on this. So let's just launch it, I guess. But it's cool, you know, you will have the controllers sold with the console. And with all of these things, some people are speculating as well. There's no colors on the buttons or really anywhere on the controller anymore. And some people are speculating that there might be some backlighting happening there. So that's another thing. Yeah. It's a complete speculation. It might not be the case. But even without that, the controller has a lot of technology. It might be a little bit more expensive even than the DualShock 4 was, which is starting to be quite expensive. But then at least you have the controller. So every player, every owner has all of the technology needed to play all the games, but you also can use your PlayStation 4 controllers if you have like a two-player game or something like that, so you don't have to absolutely have to buy a second controller off the bat. So
I think the most in-demand feature of the DualShock or the DualSense controller would be the battery life, because I think a lot of people complain that the battery life on the DualShock 4 is atrocious.
It's so bad.
I saw some meme the other day that said that the reason why you have a second PlayStation 4 controller is so you can charge it while you play with the other one. That's the only reason you get it. It's not to play a second player game. So,
well, I have to admit, it's very rare nowadays that people play, at least in my environment and maybe my age group, that people play with two. You know, you have two people catch co-op or combat. Nowadays, but yeah, the battery life is so bad on those controllers. It's like, I don't know, 7 to 9 hours, something like that.
Right.
And they didn't comment on this specifically, but I really hope it's better than that. It is like the Xbox controller is great for that aspect. I mean, it works on removable batteries, which of course you have rechargeable batteries for that. At least I do, and everyone should. But it is really bad. I hope it's better. And the big report from Bloomberg that was just published today, I'm going to summarize it as well. Basically, the pandemic is not apparently affecting the production capabilities of Sony, but I mean, that might change, of course, down the line, but it doesn't seem to be affecting it now. However, the other thing to take into consideration is the power increase in since, you know, the generational leap, which was fairly low last generation, but this generation is much more significant. And so the price of the components is higher because of scarcity. Essentially, everyone wants RAM, and they want the latest RAM, and that's going to be a problem for everyone who wants that RAM. And so Sony is going to have to set a price that is probably higher than the launch price of PlayStation 4. And so they're considering producing less of the devices because higher price means, of course, less demand. The price is estimated to be between around $500 to $550, with the note that they might eat up some of the cost and price it at $450 instead of $500. And that is the case for the Xbox Series X as well. The cost, according to this report, should be in a similar range. And with the eating of the cost from the manufacturers, they would both end up being at $450. So how much fewer is Sony planning to produce? For PlayStation 4 at launch back in 2013, it was 7.5 million units in the first 6 months. For PlayStation 5, it seems like the range would be between 5 and 6 million units for the first 3 months or so for the fiscal year ending March 2021. So we estimate roughly 5 to 6 months. So it is a significant decrease, but it's not like there's only going to be 200,000 devices, right? I think this is a decrease that means everyone who wants one will probably be able to get one without too much difficulty if, you know, the supply chain doesn't get disrupted. So that is the key takeaway from there. That's how I read it. Now,
there's a lot of things that go into those numbers too. Like, I think they're also considering like economic fallout to the virus, like people that don't have jobs and stuff can't afford to buy PS4s or PS5s rather and stuff like that. I think that has a weighing on the numbers as well.
Yes, of course. That is a big factor, I'm sure. It should be noted that they are themselves noting if Microsoft ends up pushing the release of the Xbox Series X, Sony would follow suit with the PlayStation 5. There's a competitive thing there. It seems Microsoft is not in that mode right now, but who knows? Yeah. It's very possible. There absolutely is a world where they both kind of look at each other, put the guns back into the holsters and go like, all right, let's chill out. We'll delay it by 6 months. It will be much better next spring. And it might happen. But the other thing to take into consideration is revenue and the end of the fiscal year. If you pushed back that huge release, then you're going to have a lot less revenue. And that is not great for the stock market, which, again, is not in a great shape anyway because of everything that's happening. So I don't know how much that plays into it, but I guess at least some. So what do you think about all of this? That, like, the price, the numbers, are you worried?
So the one thing that you didn't touch on was this article has a graph that shows like the cost comparisons between the PS4 and PS5 and Xbox and Series X, and it shows that both the PS5 and Series X both put a lot more money into the storage, right, of the storage cost of the console compared to the memory cost. And so it'll be interesting to see like how people feel about that, because the PS5 and or PS4 and Xbox One had a fairly small amount of disk space, considering these games are getting bigger and bigger every year. Like my PS4 can barely hold just Red Dead on it, you know? So I'd be curious to see kind of like how that storage cost weighs into the final price, because I think they both kind of are thinking about putting SSDs in there, and if they both go with 1 terabyte SSDs, that kind of explains the massive jump in storage cost.
Yeah, and it is very expensive SSDs. It's the chart shows the comparison between the memory cost and the storage cost on the previous generation. It's essentially 2/3 for memory and 1/3 for storage. Of course, it was traditional hard drives back then. Now it's right. completely reversed. Not only is the memory cost much higher, essentially the memory cost for the new generation is equivalent to the entirety of the cost of the previous generation for memory and storage. And on top of that, you have to add double of that cost for the storage alone, which, right. yeah, that, I mean, I don't think that has a big, you know, it doesn't weigh into people's purchasing decisions. That right. like they don't care what costs what inside the box. They care about the price of the box. But it's certainly interesting to note. It's super. The SSDs are really expensive. It's like $150 just for the SSD.
Right.
For like straight up cost. So that's a lot.
Yeah, and I mean the price is a little expensive, I think, for but like, I don't know.
You mean the $450 to $500?
Yeah. You're getting a pretty high powered machine for that price, you know? Mm. And I mean, there's always going to be people that be like, yo, you can basically get the same thing for way cheaper if you build your own PC or whatever. But I don't know. I think they're not going for that market, right? Like, they're going for the more, I don't want to say casual. That's not the right word, but like
the console market is more casual. Although in this case, I don't think you can get it cheaper as a PC. It is very expensive, and we're at the launch of it, or actually, we're 6 months before the launch. It is, I have a friend who calculated the cost of the equivalent PC. I think it was like, was it over $1,000? I think it was okay. Like it's very significant. Back for the launch of PlayStation 3 and 4 and Xbox One, we were around the $700, something like that. Mm. Now it's almost double. So those are, you're right.
Yeah, they have the benefit of like economies of scale, right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And down the line, you know, in 2 years, you'll be able to build a PC that is more powerful for a fraction of that price. But those consoles have to. Honestly, if they manage to stay at around $450, which will probably end up being 500 euros, or, you know, if they stay to 450 euros, I think that's fine. It's €50 more expensive than the previous generation. For the amount of power increase, it is kind of insane. And I think $50 is still very reasonable. If we start getting to the $500 price range, that's a significant... it weighs much more significantly. I think if it's $450... some people will decide not to get it. That would have if it was $399, of course. But... there's still a majority of people who want it who will get it. I think if you reach the $500 or, God forbid, the $550 price range, then you start getting people who wanted it who won't get it, right? I think it's a significant difference. But
yeah, I mean, I think I might walk back what I said a little bit because the Xbox One, when it was originally released, was $500. So having... The next generation of consoles come out at the same, like, at that similar price point. Like, that seems appropriate to me.
Yeah. Yeah. But, well, that was because there was the Kinect in it, and they had the whole catastrophe of Kinect and then walking it back. Sure. And, yeah. Wasn't there a version without Kinect at launch as well? I can't remember.
No, there was not at launch.
It took a month to...
I think it was longer than a month. I think it was a half a year maybe. So I also just looked at the price of a $400 item back in 2013 or 2014, whenever the PS4 came out, is now that similar price is now $450 or $440. Mm. So like with inflation, it kind of makes sense that the price goes up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's not how potential
that's not
purchasers
how people get it,
will
but...
say. Yeah, of course.
yeah, for sure.
All right, that's about it. I personally will buy it no matter the price because, you know, it's my job and also I want it, but I guess you're in the same boat.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'll bite on both of the consoles first thing. I'll probably have to make a decision based on like kind of what I want out of the exclusives and stuff like that, but yeah, it's going to be probably a day one purchase for me.
Yeah, I'm guessing most of the people who are listening to this, if it ends up being 450, it's really not a question for most people because we're dedicated gamers. 550, I think, will get a few people to rethink their thing. 500, maybe a little bit as well. But
yeah.
All right. Let's talk about Microsoft just a little bit before we move on to the games we've been playing. The xCloud beta is available in many European countries, France, Finland, a bunch of others. So I, of course, registered immediately. I'm hoping I'm going to get the access fairly quickly. It is only on Android devices, though. You can't stream to your TV yet, and it's only a small number of games. So it's really still in testing phase, but I'm very I'm heartened by the fact that they are still they're continuing their testing. I'm hoping we will see the service hopefully start with the launch of the Series X. We'll see what happens there. And there was a bunch of things in the Insider video. Nothing honestly earth-shattering or even earth-trembling, but There was more information on Grounded, the survival game when you're a tiny thing in an insect world, which looked cooler than I thought it was going to be. It's the game from Obsidian. It's releasing in early access on July 28. Gears Tactics is coming soon. Sea of Stars looks pretty interesting. It's a retro 16-bit era RPG Sea of Stars?
And from the makers of The Messenger.
Yes, there you go. And
which was a great, fantastic game that came out a few years ago.
I played it a little bit. It's in the same world as well. I played it a little bit. The Messenger was, I think, more 8-bit, and it was a completely different type of...
It was 8-bit for the first part of it.
Aha, you're spoiling a little bit. And then Sea of Thieves is continuing its updates and fighting the good fight. So if you like that, that's cool. Anything that caught your eye in all of this?
Sea of Stars. Even Gears Tactics kind of raises an eyebrow for me. I'm interested to see I'm waiting and watching for that one. Like if it gets really good reviews, then I probably will pick it up because I do like those turn-based tactics games.
Gears Tactics, right.
Yeah.
By the way, did you see that there's an XCOM coming? They just like announced it in tiny... It's coming in like 10 days. It's XCOM Renegade, XCOM... What is it? What's it called? Chimera. There you go. Chimera Squad. It feels like a new XCOM game would be a bigger deal, but anyway... So the Gears Tactics, Sea of Stars, both looked pretty cool. I don't think they're my jam, but they look pretty cool. Grounded was surprisingly intriguing, I think. And since this is all on Game Pass, again, the wonders of Game Pass. So I'll probably give one or two of them a try. And we are back from the freezing of Ed's computer. So I was asking, you're not playing Final Fantasy VII Remake. I was a little bit surprised.
I am going to play it. It's downstairs in my package room waiting for me because it arrived a few days late for me just because of all the other...
Out of spite, you were like, well, I'm not playing you now.
Well, it just came yesterday, so, haven't...
That's fair.
I just haven't gone down and gotten it yet. We're doing like social distancing stuff down here too, so I can't even go to the package room after hours. Like I have to do it during main hours.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, so I've been playing it, and honestly, It is. I am very surprised. I'm sure, you know, everyone listening to this has heard that it is being hailed as a great success, often unexpectedly so, because it seemed like a daunting task, and attacking something that is this emblematic is always difficult. Final Fantasy VII, for those who don't know or remember, was a watershed moment in gaming history, at the very least in role-playing gaming history. The Japanese role-playing game genre was extremely well-known and popular in the small community that the gaming community was back then, and Final Fantasy was its it's the best of what it could be. And Square, which wasn't Square Enix back then, decided to forego Nintendo and make a deal with the PlayStation devil to change what gaming, what role-playing games could be. And we went from the 16-bit era of the Super Nintendo, which was, of course, you know, wonderful little pixelated graphics that we love today, but which weren't progress back then, even though they were really great, and into the world of CD-ROM media and everything that could enable not only CD-ROM, but of course 3D. And as boxy as the models look to us today, and they very much are, it was revolutionary because the backgrounds were incredible and the cutscenes were amazing and all of that. And so that was the most memorable experience that many people had on PlayStation, and certainly for role-playing games for that era. So remaking something like that is a very daunting task, especially if you don't limit yourself to making new models and having the exact same thing with the same systems and the same scenario and everything. And what they decided to do is to reimagine what the game could be if it was designed today. It's a true remake. It's not just a remaster. It is many, many changes of the game, including the main combat system, which is the main aspect of the game. The other thing that should be mentioned immediately is it covers part of the original game, the part where you're in the big city of Midgar, which is maybe 5 to 7 hours in the original game. The original game was maybe 40 to 50 hours long. And in this version, they have extended the beginning part to a 30 to 40 hours game experience. So they added a bunch of things, some side quests, some additional storytelling narration of side characters, and a lot of things to make it a lot longer. So that already was a big reservation for a lot of people. But in spite of this, everyone seems to be loving the remake, and myself included. I was very skeptical until maybe a few months ago, let's say last E3, but I started getting hopeful these past few months. Of course, we should mention that when the game was announced, was it 2016, 2017, mm-hmm. 2016, something like that. We were certain we would not be seeing this until 2022 or 23, if at all.
Yeah, it was like announced alongside, not announced at the same time, but Final Fantasy 15 was also like in the similar announcement time frame, I think.
Yeah, the Final Fantasy 15, maybe it was a year before. Was the 15 was kind of a rebranding of Versus 13, which took so long to make that right. They decided to. So what do I think about the game? It is great, as I've said. I think there are three main pillars of the game. It is nostalgia is a big part of it. Definitely. The graphics are, in parts of the game, stunning, like literally stunning. And in parts of the game, kind of disappointing, but the stunning parts and the feeling of being, which ties into nostalgia, being in those environments that you couldn't really explore in the same way back then, seeing them now is kind of amazing. The models for the main characters are incredible, all of that. And then the third pillar is the gameplay system and the active time battle system, which is essentially a refinement of the system from Final Fantasy 15 and Kingdom Hearts 3, it really works. And the changes that they've brought to this iteration of it are absolutely efficient. I think for most people, you can't wait to get into another battle to have that system a little bit more. I'll spend a little bit of time. Yeah. I'll spend a bit of time explaining it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on it real quick. I played through all Final Fantasy 15, and by the end of that game, the combat system was getting kind of boring a little bit. Like, you're basically just button mashing a single button and maybe dodging occasionally, but from everything I've heard and read from the remake, it sounds like it's an improvement in every single way.
Did you have the staggering system in Final Fantasy 15?
No, but the staggering system was heavily featured in the 13 series.
Okay.
13-2, and then Lightning Returns. And so, right, I played through those two.
Yeah, so I guess that's why a lot of people reference that one as well.
Right.
So the way it works is you control one of the characters from your party, which your party is limited to three characters, and the others are kind of doing a little bit, but not a lot actively. They're not inactive, but they're not incredibly, like, they're not going to change the course of the battle. So you control one of the characters, and you can do active things like swinging your sword at an enemy, deciding which enemy you're going to attack. And all the while, the more you attack and get damage, your active time battle bar fills up. And you usually have two sections of that bar. And for each section, you can do an action. So you button mash if you want to, and then every few seconds, you can decide to do an action, which can be use an ability, cast a spell, use an item, things like that. So when you do that, you pause the game, essentially. It goes into super, super slow-mo. It's not completely paused, which is pretty cool, actually, because you still have to make a decision, but you have a lot of time to make that decision. But you can't just put the controller down and go away, because the battle is still going. And you can do that every few seconds. And you can also decide to do that for the other characters in your party, which you're not controlling directly, which means you still have to take a part in deciding how they act in the battle. And you can also switch which character you control. So there's already a lot of active strategy in there, and you can decide how you're going to create your build with, I'm not going to go into all the details, but the materia system is still there. You can customize your weapons with essentially what is a spec tree, which starts mattering a little bit more down the line. You have different types of items and equipment, all of that good RPG stuff. And so you decide how you will approach the battle, and then you have to take an active part in it. And the other aspect is that staggering thing, which we just mentioned. Different enemies have different types of vulnerabilities. And as you know, this is also a very common aspect of JRPGs. If you attack them with something they're weak to enough, it will put them in a state where they're more vulnerable. And so it creates a lot of different strategies and things you have to do. And so there's a very good mix between the turn-based aspect of it and the active aspect, and it works. It gels together super well. Like, I say there are three pillars of the game, and I believe there are, but one of them is like 50% of the enjoyment, and that's the battle system, which is really great. I would love to see, like, just action games use that more action games, like games based on that system. I think they have a real gem there, and they have to keep iterating on it. It works really well, so I'm very happy about that aspect. Yeah. There are, it's not perfect. I was thinking about how to describe the game for the show, and I think what I ended up on was a game with double A ambitions, but triple A execution. The double A ambitions, it's still a lot of one-way hallways. There's a lot of that. Like, it's essentially a one giant hallway. You don't have an open world in any sense of the word. You have side quests that are very side quest-y. Not unenjoyable. I'm really enjoying them. But they're, you know, you understand they're side quests. And they are padding. Enjoyable padding, but padding still. You have, sometimes you're gonna see something that is like very badly textured, and you're like, "Whoa, that right. doesn't look good." And it's very sectioned off, like the game you have. Now you're in this section, and now you're in that section, and it is at the border on the ambitions, on the design of the game between AA and AAA. You know, there are so many AA Japanese games. Japanese gaming companies have found themselves in the AA genre. You know, things like Devil May Cry, Resident Evil 2 Remake, like a bunch of other of things like that, which are great, great AA, verging on AAA titles, but they're not as ambitious as the big Western productions. This one has the soul of a AA title with AAA execution in all of the graphical prowess and the length of it and all of those things. And it is a great game, but some aspects of the Japanese-ness of it are a little bit iffy for me. There's things on the game design standpoint. There's things like, you know, it's on that AA aspect of it, and because it's an RPG, most of the interactions, the cutscenes are scripted, and the animations are, you know, they create a kit for each character, and you have the motion, the animation where they're like uncertain of something, or like wagging their finger at you, and one where they're laughing, and it's like they're chaining those animations during conversations mostly, and it doesn't quite fit, and especially since there's a lot of Japanese-ness, which I'm fine with. I've said many times I love Japan, I've been there many times, I've lived there for a while, but it is still it looks a little bit off, and there are three aspects that I think exemplify this very well. The first one, which has been discussed before, is the over-the-topness of Barrett. Like, he is angry black man stereotype as seen from the Japanese lens. Like, it is uncomfortable at times. He's like Mr. T without the nuance, which is funny because Mr. T has no nuance. But so there's that. The character of Wedge is, again, a very common trope in Japanese culture and popular culture. It's the fat dude, which it doesn't really bother me as much. I don't, you know, I'm not very attuned to the issues of the overweight community, but I've heard more than one person saying, it's really uncomfortable with Wedge being, his only defining characteristic is that he wants to eat. That's all he is. He hasn't eaten enough. He's eaten well, so he's happy. He's running on fumes. It's like, all right, we get it. And when you don't know Japanese culture and how prevalent this is, it's almost like watching something about America and not understanding why there are so many guns. Well, guns are a big part of American culture in some areas of the country, and it's just part of it. And if you look at this from the outside, you're like, dude, they really like it, really like all of the, and this is the same for the fat person. There are not many fat people in Japan for a number of reasons, but yeah, Wedge is the fat dude. And there's, of course, the scantily clad women, which Tifa, even though her breasts have been reduced in size by the Square Ethics Committee, which this is a real thing, I'm not joking, she is scantily clad. And she's not like, she's all timid. And like, I had that conversation on Twitter and a few people told me, yeah, you know, I get where you're coming from, but it's true to the original, which is completely fair. And some people were telling me, you know, here in where I live, which is a lot of the southern part of the US, it's completely normal attire, which I get. Okay. But it's not like, and some people were saying, oh, she's just a strong woman. She can dress like she wants. And like, I understand that aspect. That's not what this is about, though. This is the remake of a game from the mid-90s where the design was, let's make eye candy for horny teenage Japanese boys. And it is, at least to me, and I've heard from a few others, it is a little bit unnerving to see her. Like, she's walking around in the middle of, I don't know, imagine, well, I'm going to talk about what I know, like Paris or New York or Boston, like these places where people are dressed in suits or t-shirts and jeans. Like, it's not the beach, and it's not, you know, I don't know, Florida. You're not like in the Arizonian desert. Like, it's a regular place. Everyone is dressed normally, and she's walking around with those super short shorts and like this top that is, anyway, it, women can dress how they want. But in this case in particular, This was designed to be for horny teenage boys. So, and it shows, at least for me in my experience. So those little things are like, this is really a Japanese game. But even though I did spend a little bit of time on this because I didn't want to, you know, not mention it, it is still an amazing game. And it's not deterring so much from my enjoyment of the game. I'm about 15 hours in, and I can't wait to play more. I'm really, really enjoying it, and I never thought I would. So, yeah, it's cool. I sort of interrupted you from interrupting me a couple of times there. Was there something you wanted to add?
No, I mean, I think the only thing that I would add is that Wedge didn't have much to his character in the original game either, so like having his character be boiled down to the fact that he's a fat person to like kind of like is in line with the original game to me, and I agree with most of what you're saying about Tifa too, because Aerith is also in the game and is not dressed as scantily clad as you put.
Yeah, Aerith, you know, Aerith is interesting because she's a bit different. And I think they were, the translators or even the people at Square were aware of all of this. And they keep having the women say, oh, I'm not a princess in distress. You know, you don't have to save me.
Yeah.
And yet Cloud saves them every 2 minutes. Like, I'm exaggerating, but there are many instances where they're like, oh, I'm gonna fall, whatever will I do? And Cloud is like, yes, I will catch you. Or he doesn't say anything because he's the strong silent type, but he catches them, or you know, situations like right. that. So it's not, I mean, it's fine. Again, I'm not trying to get up on my SJW horse, even though I am an SJW, but it's not, I'm not saying, oh, it ruins the game. I'm just saying it's noticeable, you know? And, and Aerith, she, like, another thing, which when she runs, it's just the animation. It shows which society this comes from. And I mean Japan as society. When she runs, mm-hmm. imagine how you would caricature when you tell someone, oh, how do you think a weak 6-year-old girl, how do you think she would run? And she's like, her arms all over the place and her feet going up in different directions. That's how right. Aerith runs. You know, she's like, she doesn't run like a human. She runs like the caricature of a weak woman would be imagined to be running in that context. It's it's small things. It just doesn't matter all that much, but it's noticeable. And yeah, still the game is awesome. I love it. I'm amazed that they pulled it off. I can't wait to see what they do at the end to kind of open it up. And and at the same time, I have significant dread because I fear that we won't see the rest of the adventure anytime soon. And if we do, it won't be the full thing. Like, how many episodes is it going to be? 3, 4? How can they do the breadth of that thing that came out in 95 or 97, was it? With the quality of what they're doing now with this very small section of it, it would be like almost impossible. And if they expand, like they're not going to expand it as much for every part of it. So I don't know. It is a mystery and a wonder, and it's amazing, and I love it. And also, I'm a bit scared of what's going to happen next. So,
yeah, I've been spending some time kind of in the lead up to it playing the original on the Switch.
I want to do that. I want to go back and play it now.
And so I'm about to drop a bomb here, but especially because I have actually never played the original.
Okay.
So I have played Final Fantasies 1 through 6 and 13 and 15. So there was a big gap in my consumption of Final Fantasy. And so I've been playing through the original, and I'm still in Midgar kind of pretty early, but it's kind of good. You know, there might be something to this whole Final Fantasy VII cult of people that love it so much. So,
yeah.
I also like how you can fast forward. You can increase the clock speed by 3 times, so you can get into the battles faster and get out of them faster and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, I heard about this. How do you look? So, what does that affect?
So basically, it just makes the game run faster. It's like when you're if you've ever emulated a game and you hold down the space bar to speed up everything, it just makes it all go faster. And so there is an animation that happens as you enter battle that is really slow for today's tendencies. And so I just happen every time I go into battle, I press the button to speed it up so it would just get me into battle faster.
Okay. You say battle with Final Fantasy VII, and in my mind I hear that music and the way it's redone. Oh, so much awesomeness. And the music in Midgar and the opening intro. Oh, that game.
Yeah, they've never shied away from good music in that series, that's for sure.
All right, that is it for Final Fantasy VII, a good amount of time, deservedly so. So tell us about In Other Waters and Iron Danger.
Yeah, sure. So In Other Waters is, I don't know, did you ever play Subnautica, Patrick?
I played it and I didn't. I'm one of the only people in the world who didn't like it.
Okay, so this has a similar premise as Subnautica, where you're kind of trapped on an alien planet underwater, but the way you play it is completely different. Instead of being first person and you're walking around gathering things, you're actually kind of you're the AI of a robot or of the suit that the person is walking around in, and you have to control her and show her where to go. And you do that by scanning the areas around you by using your little radar thing. And I put in our little chat here the screenshot of the UI, which I tweeted on my Twitter account. But
this is very minimalistic.
Yes, it's very minimalistic, but the control scheme, the buttons are there and listed, and you can get rid of them if you want to, but the controls are very intuitive, where you are basically going through scanning the area around you, using the right control stick to decide where what you want to scan, and the left control stick kind of decides where you want to move, and you're using the UI to kind of move yourself through, gather things around you, and then you can then use those items to kind of traverse the world as you discover more things about the world. And so it's kind of a cool thing that every time you scan a plant or an animal, it gives you a little bit of description of that plant or animal. And then eventually, after you have to scan it enough times, the person that you're playing as will name the thing and then catalog it. And then on the ship, once you finish the full discovery and catalog of that animal, then it'll actually put a little sketch as if the person had actually drawn out what it looks like. And so, I don't know, it's kind of a cool little game. Little elements of Metroidvania, where you're discovering new abilities and new items that allow you to traverse places that you couldn't before or get past things. An example, at the beginning of the game, you get this ability to, you're completely surrounded by these stalks of kind of underwater bamboo, and so you can't actually traverse through those areas until you get this item that allows you, that if you gather it if you throw it at the stalks, it'll like explode and all the stalks will recede so you can walk over it. So just kind of like a cool little minimalistic UI game, and I'm still pretty early in it, but it's been a lot of fun so far.
Cool. All right. That sounds like something that is not for me, but which I'm happy you're enjoying. In Other Waters.
In Other Waters. And then the other game I've been playing recently is called Iron Danger. And this is a kind of point and click action RPG, kind of like Diablo or whatever. The thing that kind of breaks it apart is that it's turn-based in a sense, and time, and you control time by going forward and backwards on this little time scale. You have like these things called heartbeats, which is like a half a second on the scale, and you can go through 7 seconds of time. And so the way it works is that you can you move by clicking around on the map, and then if an enemy attacks you, you can reverse time back to before he attacked you and choose to block during that half second time frame. And so you're constantly like getting hit and then rewinding time and then trying to figure out how to block or move out of the way of the enemy attack, and then you can attack them and stuff like that. And your moves and attacks take a certain number of heartbeats to act on too. And so just kind of like a little bit of a mix of an action RPG plus tactics at the same time. And it's a very unique concept that I haven't really seen in a lot of games before. So I'm having fun with it. It's a little bit of a slow burn, slow moving crawl, because you're constantly getting into combat, rewinding time and taking your time through the combat scenarios. But it's been a lot of fun so far. So highly recommend both those games.
Are they both on Steam or?
Yeah, so both of them are on Steam. And then I've been playing In Other Waters on the Switch.
Okay, all right. But Iron Danger is not on the Switch.
No.
Mm-mm. Okay. All right. I'm a little bit curious about Iron Danger, but I think I'll go check out something on YouTube to get a clearer image of what it is. But all right. And you haven't been playing Resident Evil 3. I've heard good-ish and bad-ish things.
I've heard it's shorter than RE2 was, and that's been kind of disappointing to people. But it's still a beautiful game, and you know, they seem to love the remakes over there at Capcom when it comes to Resident Evil nowadays. So I guess that kind of leads into the next story. But
it seems it's less of a success, first because the novelty has worn off a little bit. It's very similar to Resident Evil 2, a lot more action oriented, which is rubbing some people the wrong way, but also shorter because you can't replay it. But yeah, it seems there is another one. Last week I was saying, I guess now they have to go to Resident Evil 8 and continue the series properly, but maybe not. They might be preparing Resident Evil 4 for 2022. And I mean, Resident Evil 4 still had tank controls, but it was a lot more modern than the other two. So I don't know how interesting a remake would be. I wonder if it isn't going to fall into that Resident Evil 3 bucket rather than the Resident Evil 2 remake bucket, which I guess we'll see if it comes out in 2022 is what we're hearing now. I'm sure they're working on both in parallel. I'm sure they're working on 8 as well. But would you be interested in a remake of the 4th?
Yeah, I mean, so funny story. I actually played the 4th for the first time back in December for a like 24-hour marathon stream. And maybe not the best way to play that game, but that game is actually fairly long. So I'd be interested to see if it falls in the same trappings as RE3, because I think there's a lot there to kind of like, even with some improvements, make it a little bit scarier, and it gets very actiony at the end, and it's kind of a slog there at the end. So, and people generally do not like the last, I guess, quarter of that game. So I think
there's opportunities to remake
things. Yeah, there's opportunity, exactly. Yep. Yeah.
All right.
Something else I wanted to mention real quick is Iron Danger is based off of Finnish folklore. With a little bit of steampunk mixed in there. So I don't know if that raises your interest even more.
Yeah, a little bit actually. I'm going to make a note here.
I know my audience, Patrick.
Someone who doesn't know their audience is Phil Harrison. Phil Harrison, if I'm not mistaken, presided over the launch of PlayStation 3, one of the worst console launches in history, over the launch of Xbox One, one of the worst console launches of in history, and over the launch of Google Stadia. At what point do we start saying that Phil Harrison doesn't really know what the hell he's doing? And maybe, maybe it's completely different. He might have a good, he knows a lot about what he should be doing, but there are circumstances and he's managing, whatever he can, the way he can. I don't know. But am I right? Was he at Sony for PlayStation 3? That's the case, right?
He did a bunch of public demonstrations and stuff like that when it first came out. And then, he was at Microsoft as well during the release of the Xbox One.
What? How? Anyway. he was executive vice president at Sony. He was... what was he at Microsoft? I think he was even higher up than that. Can't remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Bottom line, Google announced that the free tier of Google Stadia is now available to anyone who has a Google Gmail address. Essentially, everyone in the world can now access Stadia. Of course, you don't get, you still have to buy the games, but you also get 2 months of Stadia Pro for free, which means you have 10 games that you can play right now, and you can play as long as you have a decent connection, which honestly many people where the service is available have. Then you don't need anything. You just go to stadia.com and you can start playing. It is magical, and most of the time it works pretty well, and yet no one cares. Why? Well, in part because we have other things to worry about and other games, but also in part because what the hell is Google thinking? What was this announcement? It made about as much noise as a tree falling in a forest with no one around to hear it. It was horrendously managed. It was just a blog post, essentially. And it was it's available now. They didn't have any ramp up, any buzz. No one who was invited to journalists to showcase something about it, nothing. It is horrendous. It's the worst way of launching such an important product I've ever seen. And if you sense some frustration in my voice, it's because I'm really frustrated by what they're doing. I mean, I don't care. It's not, the reality of it is the technology works and the technology is going to be used by other players, actors in that space. And so it's not like I care about Google succeeding there, but it's such a waste. It's such... Ed, explain to me how that makes sense, because it doesn't.
I don't know, man. I was skeptical of Stadia from the beginning. I mean, there's the elements of streaming gaming in general, which works some places and doesn't work in other places.
Does it work for you or not at all?
It does. Okay. I actually played Stadia at PAX. I played Doom, the new Doom game. And it was a little rough. Let me put it that way. Doom is a fast paced shooter, right? And so you need a quick response time. And so I was feeling like the response time was just slightly off. And so when I was playing it, and so I don't know, I don't want to make that a full indictment of streaming gaming with shooters, especially, but it definitely rubbed me the wrong way. Also, it crashed like two or three times. Actually, it might have been four or five times while I was playing it. So that was also interesting. But I don't know. There's the other element of like Google. If their projects fail, they tend to just kind of shut them off, you know. So like, there's
and
a
the
little
fact
bit
that
of
you need to
consumer wear there.
Yeah, the fact that you need to buy the games there means that if you have a subscription and you're playing the games as long as you have the subscription, yeah, you lose your saves and stuff like that, but it doesn't feel like you've lost something. If you buy the games and it goes away, which I don't think it will, but still, I understand that. But you know, I understand all of this. At the same time, I'm going to do it live, okay? I launch a browser window. I type Stadia, enter. Now the website is loaded. I'm going down to, let's say, Samurai Showdown. And I press play. And there you go. The game is launched. It's like, I don't know. It's crazy. Okay, the game is still launching. It was the opening thing. But now the game is launched. It's a little bit... such a wasted opportunity. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter. It is one bit of news that is frustrating, but that's it. Amazon is apparently jumping into that game streaming future as well. So we'll see how that goes. Their project is called Tempo, which is interesting. Well, not the name, but the fact that they are definitely, we suspected they would, but cloud gaming is coming from Amazon as well, it seems. They've delayed New World, their MMO, but Crucible, the competitive shooting game, is coming in May, so we'll see how that goes. A bunch of little tidbits. ESRB and PEGI, so the American and European game rating boards, have created a new label to clearly indicate if a game includes some loot boxes. And they have different names for them, but that's what they are. Previously, they had created a label which indicated if the game had in-game purchases, which was essentially useless as things relate to loot boxes because... almost all the games have right. in-game purchases, and that does. Now they are finally making loot boxes, which I think is something that was coming, and it's good that they're doing it, and at least now people know.
Yeah, it's like the original purpose of the ESRB, at least in the States, was to like, they didn't want, the gaming industry didn't want the government involved in regulation of gaming. And so they created the ESRB as kind of like a way to stave that off. And so every time the government gets in a little bit of a tizzy about like certain gaming stuff, like they were with loot boxes, it's nice to see the ESRB come in and be like, wait, we'll just go ahead and put it on the label so that you guys don't have to get involved. It's okay.
Yeah, it was fairly similar in Europe for PEGI. I wonder, however, why they did it now and not when the big thing was happening, because now the government has other fish to fry. I don't know why now, like literally 2 days ago, they started saying this, but I guess maybe they heard rumblings about some senators still wanting to do it, but PEGI announced it the next day. So I think there was some consultation there and saying, I think we have to do it at some point. And it's so ridiculous. Why did they not do it earlier? I'm sure there are some political things like politics within the big developers
gaming
and publishers
industry.
There. Yeah. Yeah. But it's
that's
like,
what I was gonna say.
It will change nothing. It's literally a label on the warning thing that says includes random items or something for sale. Like it's the smallest thing, but you know, it at least now if you're looking for the ratings, you can know what the games include, which can be useful. You know, I don't buy that idea that children are spending thousands of dollars and ruining their parents by buying loot boxes. I don't think that's the issue, but I still think it should be mentioned. And now it is.
Right.
It says include in-game purchases, parentheses, includes random items, close parentheses. So now we know. Things are looking better at Rockstar. And Jason Schreier is reporting on that. He made a big report a year and a half ago when Red Dead Redemption 2 came out about the working conditions at Rockstar, which were pretty horrendous. And it's one of the conversation starters or conversation restarters that made the discussions about crunch and working conditions in the gaming industry resurface and become very prevalent. And, you know, I really like Schreier's work ethics. I think he is extremely militant and he will let you know what he thinks should happen. And that is completely fair. And I think it's important. But he's also incredibly objective about the way he reports. He always sees if there are two sides, which there aren't always two sides, but often there are, and he will be very clear in explaining that this is how some people view things, this is how he interprets things, or usually in the reports he doesn't talk about how he interprets things, but he's very objective. And in something like this, it is a essentially the way the article reads is a little bit cautious, as of course everyone should be, but it is a celebration of how Rockstar has shifted the bad behavior that they were taking part of in the past. And the people who were in contact with Schreier have been telling him that they are now reconsidering their plans to leave that they had made because of the attitude of management and things like that. There are people who were let go, essentially, because of their bad managerial skills. We've all heard about all of this. Dan Houser actually left. It seems it might be related to that. A bunch of other things. I'm not going to go over all of it, but essentially, things are looking fairly hopeful at Rockstar, and it's the slightly, what's the opposite of a silver lining? Like the dark lining is the fact that are the dark clouds. That's a little bit more ominous, but it seems Rockstar is reevaluating the scope of the games they're making because it is impossible to make such ambitious games without having working people to the bone. And so they're it seems the next GTA, which is still, you know, very early in development, might have a smaller scope than something like Red Dead Redemption 2. But that's, you know, interpretation and rumor. And but I mean, do we need the balls of the horses to shrink in winter? Is that the level of ambition we need in the games? I don't know. I don't have the answer, but it's very interesting. It is fairly positive. Of course, we're not in crunch period, so things might change, but it is a positive sign, and I hope we're going to get more of those in the coming months and years for other studios that were pointed at as being bad actors in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to see the kind of impact that like strong journalism can have on an industry, you know? And just the fact that such a scathing review of Rockstar turned into something that's good, it just kind of gives you the warm fuzzies inside, you know?
I agree. I think, you know, this is, I know a lot of people, some people in some communities are placating gaming journalists, and there is no better example than this. And maybe, you know, as Schreier, if you want to read this like the wrong way, you might say, oh, Schreier is trying to show how much good he does and how powerful he is, but
right,
I don't think that's why he does it. He's very he's very involved and implicated in those topics, but the fact is he didn't single-handedly make this happen. It wasn't just him. There were maybe, you know, a handful of reporters, but he still had the biggest part in all of this. So it's fair. And whatever, the people who would say that about gaming journalists are the ones that would hate Kotaku for what they do anyway. So they don't really understand anything about all of this. And there's also another report about not so great about Gearbox and what happened there, also from Schreier. So the situation at Gearbox is that they are paid less than the industry average, but they get a lot of bonuses because when they ship big games. And that kind of over makes up for it. It's like common... my understanding is that it's not uncommon to have six-figure bonuses, and like it is things
like
that
people bought houses with their bonus they got from Borderlands 2.
Yeah, exactly. And they heard a couple of weeks back that even though they were promised big bonuses, now they're not getting them. The game sold really well, but it seems the reason for this is on the accounting side, Gearbox invested a lot of money in other things like side studios and stuff like that, and so there's not enough money left. All of this is bad enough, but on top of it, what's his face? The president of Gearbox.
Oh crap. Randy Pitchford.
Thank you, Pitchford, whom I already had reservations about. I mean, can go back and listen to previous episodes. There are many a reason to be reserved about Pitchford. But he got, last year, like $12 million on a bonus for something else, which, again, accounting-wise, it's probably a separate pool. But it doesn't help. And people are at Gearbox are pissed off, understandably so. That's especially now. Like, what are you going to do? You're going to leave Gearbox and find another job in the middle of the pandemic? It is a really shitty thing to do. And I don't know how much Pitchford had to do with it. I'm sure he was involved in the decision-making process. He's the boss there. It's crappy.
Yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind is that the profits for the game are supposed to be split 60-40. So 60% goes to the company and 40% goes to the employees. And so they announced like last pay period or the pay period before this article came out that Borderlands 3 had officially become profitable. And so people were like waiting. They're like, okay, that means we get our first royalty check soon or whatever. And then they met them and they got all together in a room and just like, were like, you're not getting anything. Sorry.
And of course, profitable is, you know, that happens in every artistic industry. It's like, you know, however much we can put in the expense column, that staves off the thing being profitable. And that's where the opening of another studio or something, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was like the money was spent on other things that are counted as expenses. So it's like, yeah, sure, it's only profitable now. Maybe it sold a little bit less than it you were hoping for, but it was a big game. It sold well. And I mean, it's a shitty thing to do anyway.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Quick succession of little tidbit newses of news tidbits. World of Warcraft Shadowlands may have a Noto Battler mode, which is an expansion of the mission table. Also, the gamepad settings on WoW, that's weird. I'm sure it's not like the game fully playable on gamepad, but there are some settings to enable commands to be made on gamepad. It might be an accessibility thing.
Yeah, I mean, so like Final Fantasy 14, you can play that on consoles. I know it's built for that, but like the way you select like different commands is by using the triggers to kind of as a like alternative ability. Mm. So if they kind of have that kind of built into the UI and stuff like that, I think it could work.
Yeah. And maybe we'll see. I don't think that's what it is, but there's also ray tracing reports of the things that, like, I would love to see World of Warcraft and ray tracing. That's the reason to get a new graphics card. That's why you do it. Riot there's been a lot of talk about Valorant, and I look at it as an Overwatch fan. The conclusion there is it is not for me. We all thought it was very much Counter-Strike. It turns out it is only Counter-Strike. It is a Counter-Strike clone with a little bit added on top of it. And I'm sure it's going to be very cool. And the Counter-Strike crowd is going to be, which is very large, is going to be very happy to move on to Valorant. But yeah, I don't think it's going to be for the general public. If you're an Overwatch fan and looking at that, it seems like it's not for you. The pros might have a different opinion, but... Cellar Door Games announced Rogue Legacy 2. CD Projekt is saying that Cyberpunk 2077 is still holding for September. CD Projekt is apparently used to working remotely, so that doesn't change a lot for them. We're getting a Crysis remaster for those who enjoyed it back in, what was it, 2004 or 7?
Yeah, something like that.
Warzone, Call of Duty Warzone has 50 million players who signed up in the first month. That's as much as Apex Legends. That's a lot of people. Uncharted Collection and Journey are free on PlayStation 4 right now. So go get them. You keep them forever if you get them now. I think it's for a couple of weeks, a little bit more. What else? The E3 has dates for 2021, and Gamescom will be digital only this year. Gamescom is canceled, essentially. It will be digital. We're going to get something. I hope we're going to get lots of demos. And yeah, that's about it. Anything out of all of this that interests you?
Yeah, the Rogue Legacy 2 announcement is super exciting. I love that first game. Mm. It's almost the perfect roguelike for me. I think one thing to note is that if you have the Uncharted Collection and Journey on PlayStation Plus, you cannot get them for free or like as a permanent buy on the store. It's just not set up for that. So you have to actually like submit a ticket to Sony to get them to remove it from your account so that you can then get the free version.
Oh,
so
that's why it marked it as purchased already on my system.
Yeah, okay. So just something to keep in mind for if you want to if you want it permanently, that's how you have to do it. It's a little bit of a hoop you have to jump through, but maybe if there's enough tickets that go in, then Sony will like change their process so that it's easier.
Yeah, I think they're going to wait until, you know.
So everyone put 5. In a ticket.
You know, I don't care enough, and I know I'm going to be a PlayStation Plus subscriber until the end of my life. So I'm not going to do it. I have
don't,
more.
Don't tell Sony that. Don't tell Sony.
Okay,
that.
Okay, all right.
That'll,
all
right. That'll make them not do anything.
All right, so that's noted. And yeah, I mean, Rogue Legacy was basically what repopularized roguelikes. Yeah. Back in, you know, a few years ago. So I'm curious to see. And there are interesting changes in Rogue Legacy 2 that are coming as well. It's coming fairly soon and in early access, is it? Or am I mistaken? I think that's the case. And wait, maybe not early access.
I thought...
I'm confused.
Yeah, maybe not. The first game wasn't early access. So maybe... I think they just put up a banner and said... It's a thing. They didn't really give any extra details to it, so
okay.
I don't know.
Right. Oh yeah. It's this summer, and it's not early access, but it's this summer announced for PC only. So we'll see what happens there.
Okay.
All right, and I guess that is it for this episode of Pixels. Thank you so much for being with me, Ed, from home, sheltered and safe. And where would people go if they want more from your side of the gaming world?
Yeah, so if you can follow me on Twitter at Adesis, that'll be in the show notes, I'm sure. And then if you want to follow kind of more of my goings-on related to the website that I work on, it's 4playernetwork.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much. For me, it's Patrick Beja, not Patrick, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Go check out my Instagram. It's pretty cool. And if you want to comment on this episode, it's at frenchspin.com. And that's it. We will be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode. Until then, stay home, stay safe, wash your hands, don't touch your face, and be good. We'll be back to talk about video games. Bye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.